Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Central Ohio has a brand new congressional district, the 3rd congressional district, a Democrat-leaning swath of political territory that stretches from Clintonville into Westerville. On March 6, Democratic primary voters will choose among 4 candidates to run in the November general election for that seat: Mary Jo Kilroy, Joyce Beatty, Priscilla Tyson, and Ted Celeste. On Monday, we heard from former Congresswoman Mary Jo Kilroy. On Tuesday, we heard from Columbus City Councilwoman Priscilla Tyson. Yesterday, former Minority Leader of the Ohio House of Representatives, Joyce Beatty, joined us. Today, we welcome Ted Celeste. He's a state representative from Grandview Heights, where he also runs a real estate business. First, let's listen to his first television ad.
I'm Ted Celeste, and I approve this positive message. I'm running for Congress in Central Ohio's 3rd District to bring a different brand of politics to solve some very real problems. I believe these problems can only be solved by citizens working together in a collaborative and civil fashion. We only succeed when everyone plays by the same rules, gets a fair shot, and does their fair shares. Please join me in working to change Congress.
And I did clear it with Ted. That really is his kitchen in that political advertisement. Welcome to the show, Ted Celeste.
Thank you. So good to be here, Ann.
In that ad, you say we only succeed when everyone works together, plays by the same rules, and gives everyone a fair shot. How do you define success?
Well, I think the success is specifically when people start dealing with the problems and attacking problems and not each other. I mean, that's the success, when we're able to really find common ground and solve some of the really difficult problems.
So how would you rate Congress these days then on that way?
I think I'd share what the public's view is, that it's not doing a very good job and it's broken and needs to be fixed.
When you come in, if you are elected to that job, you go in as a minority member with no status per se in Washington. How do you make a change when you go in at that rate?
Well, you know, that's interesting that you put it in that view, because I'm not sure I'd agree that we'd necessarily be in the minority. There are a lot of things.
That's true. There might be some changes. I mean, there's supposed to be quite a bit of turnover, but that would have to be a lot of turnover.
Sure. And I have a lot of confidence in the president and in the message of the Democratic Party, but frankly, I've been in both the minority and the majority in the Ohio House, and I've actually accomplished as much or more in the minority. I actually passed a bill on dyslexia in a Republican House, Republican Senate, Republican governor, passed the bill. I was the lead sponsor on dyslexia for our young people. Tens of thousands of kids will benefit from that legislation, and it was in a totally Republican administration and legislature.
Was it just so not controversial?
Well, see, that's part of it. It's being able to speak up for people who can't speak for themselves. And that ends up being a bipartisan issue, where people are able to, you know, issues like mental health and health care. There are opportunities to really deal with those that work across the aisle.
My guest is Ted Celeste. He's one of 4 candidates for the Democratic primary for Ohio's 3rd congressional district. If you have a question or comment for Ted Celeste, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It's nice and quick and easy. If you want to go to Facebook as well, the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page is ready, willing, and able to take your comments or questions. What do you think has been the clearest success in Congress in the last 2 terms? In other words, over the course of the Obama administration?
Frankly, I think that the turning around of the economy has been the greatest success. And if there's anything that was problematic about it, we probably didn't do enough. There was so much bickering and battling over whether infrastructure, increasing dollars to infrastructure was the way to go, so that I think we should have spent more money. It did create the kind of jobs. It did get the country back to work. And you're seeing the progress now in the fact that unemployment has come down, more people are working. We haven't finished the job, and that's what I think is the important remaining task.
Ultimately, at this point, it's correlative. It's not causal. We don't know actually if that's what's turned the economy around or given it the little uptick that it's experiencing right now. So you would have gone farther. You would have done more.
I would have. Correct.
Your TV ad, the first one, was the first to hit the airwaves.
Correct.
Given the truncated nature of this race, the primary was moved from May or June up to March. Quite a big difference in the political arena. Did that give you any advantage, do you think, though, that you got up first?
I don't know whether it was an advantage. I think it was important for people to hear that message, to be introduced to a different concept. It's really important to me that people understand that I'm all about a positive campaign. I'm all about civil dialogue, and I'm all about reaching across the aisle to solve problems, not to bicker, not to fight each other, but to get to the common ground.
Why do you think it's time to change venues as an elected public official? Why Washington? Why now?
I think it's an absolutely appropriate time. We have this brand new district design, which is totally new. No incumbent. It's an exciting district. The fact that we have resources that to bring to bear on the problems. But we have incredible resources. We also have very difficult problems. We can bring to bear those resources on those problems and do it in a way that takes advantage of something that I've done in my House experience here in Ohio, and that is work across the aisle, find common ground, and really work at attacking the problems and not people.
How good is it for the voters, though, that it's such a non-competitive district? I know possibly a few of your opponents have said, wait a minute, a Republican could win. There's no guarantees in life. But if we look at the numbers and crunch them, everybody knows it's a very, very safe Democratic district. And whoever wins the Democratic primary likely will win in the general election. So how is that good for voters?
Well, and I think that one of the problems is the redistricting process has to be changed. This was an awful process, and it's led to lousy districts. We've lucked out here in Columbus by having this district all in the county. It's one of the few places in the state that this has happened, all in the county. And so there is an opportunity to really focus on Central Ohio this way. But the redistricting process itself has to be changed. It's got to be taken out of partisan hands.
What do you think the likelihood is of that is? It's going to be another decade, and it seems like nothing ever gets done and no one ever worries about it until it's too late.
Well, I'm glad you raised that. There's four of us, a Republican and Democrat in the House, a Republican and Democrat in the Senate, who've been working on legislation to come up with a way to change the process so it truly does become more competitive. It becomes more representative of what the state looks like. And actually, we're going to be introducing the bill within the next week.
In your 2005 run for the Ohio House, you refused to respond to Republican attacks, and you beat your opponent soundly. In this race, there is no apparent friction. And in fact, the headline in the Dispatch about last night's debate between you and your opponents was, "Debate short on fight, but long on
Polite.
Right.
Well, actually,
one of those headlines that drags me into a story.
I know, but I'd like to take a little credit for the fact that people are more positive. Frankly, I've encouraged a number of candidates to do that, and that they can win, and it is against the political wisdom, which tells you you have to be negative, but you can win with positive campaigns.
But friction isn't bad.
Oh, friction, absolutely. Friction's not bad, and disagreement's not bad, and healthy disagreement is good. You get to some good solutions that way. So it's important to have meaningful dialogue and meaningful disagreement. But if you start with trying to find the common ground, not what sets you apart, but find that common ground, I think that's the difference.
My guest once again, Ted Celeste. He's one of four candidates in the Democratic primary for Ohio's 3rd Congressional District seat. If you have a question or comment for him, we have him for about five more minutes. 614-292-8513. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Listen, I really believe that Congress and the Senate and the President should go to Washington to represent the poor and the middle class. But overwhelmingly, the lobbyists, the special interests, the super rich, and the corporations have an undue amount of influence over our politicians. What will you do if you go to Congress to stop that?
Mike, that's a great point, and you know that is one of the reasons why we have such a partisan process going on there now, everybody responding to those interests that you're talking about. For me, What I find exciting about being able to represent this district is to show that we can do it differently. I will spend more time in the district. I will be responsive to the constituents. I'm about building community. And to me, if you have the community that you're talking about, the people who are unemployed, the people who have to deal with foreclosures, the people who are having to deal with the high cost of college and attending university, this is something that we have to be able to respond to folks within the constituency and let them know that they can help make a difference.
Mike, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Larry and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you very much for taking the call. You might have mentioned this while I was just kind of giving my name and everything, but the question I got is, I appreciate your, I'm speaking as a moderate conservative, by the way. I'm a Republican, but I really appreciate the openness and the willingness to compromise, because I think that's the only way that we're going to get through this. My question to you is, what happens to politicians? Because it seems to me that an awful lot of them must have that same kind of mentality on both sides of the aisle, but then something happens at some point and they become divisive. So what do you think happens, and how are you going to keep that from happening to you?
That's a really good question, Larry, and for me, what I found is to focus on the importance of being able to work with folks on both sides of the aisle. If you listen to your leadership in the caucus, for instance, they will tell you to be safe, to be careful, don't do things which will jeopardize us losing our majority, whatever. That's all important from a partisan political point of view, but from solving problems and really getting at being able to work together, that becomes problematic, and that's where I think it falls apart, where issues that shouldn't be become partisan.
To what extent do you think the caucus is on the same wavelength as you are when you get there? Because no matter what, you have to work with the other side of the aisle, but you have to work with your side of the aisle, too. What if they don't want you?
Absolutely. Well, you know, and I like to say I am a progressive Democrat with a little independent spirit. And the caucus here in the Ohio House has found out if I don't agree, I'm going to speak up. On several issues, that's been the case, and including the dyslexia legislation I just mentioned. I was going to introduce that together with then Leader Batchelder in the last session, and my leadership said we can't do that. It'll make it look like Republicans care, and I said, well, this is an important issue. They do care. We all care. Well, it was right before the election. Well, we went and we managed to get it back on the docket this time in this legislature, and Speaker Batchelder helped me get a good Republican co-sponsor. We got it passed.
Larry, thanks for your...
It seems to me that it's a spiral up versus a spiral down process. It's going to take some time. But, sir, if you win, please stick to your guns. I think that if there is going to be a third political party in the United States, it's going to be the Compromise Party, and I think it's going to have to happen by people that are going to be willing to stand up to their caucuses on both sides, and I think it'll change. But thank you for taking the call, and good luck.
Larry, thank you. I'll add one thing. You said a third party. I'd say it's a third way. It's the third district way, and there is an alternative to step back and look. It's not all right and left. It's not all Democrat, Republican. There is a third way.
Thanks, Larry, for that call. Harrison and Columbus, we're running out of time. I wanted to quick grab your call, though. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. I wanted to ask why... Mr. Fess, what your viewpoint is on same-sex marriage and what you intend on doing about that issue.
Harrison, thank you for the call, and I don't know whether you've seen there's already a Facebook page on same-sex marriage that's recruiting candidates and office holders to sign up for it. I was one of the first signees, and I wholeheartedly agree with it.
Harrison, thanks for that call. Ted Celeste, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ann.
That wraps up our four-part interview of the candidates in the Democratic primary for the Ohio's 3rd Congressional District seat. Coming up, we're going to turn our sights to Syria. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Pesca, coming up on the next On Point. Do charter schools make the grade? A closer look at their mixed report card. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock on 89.7 NPR News. 44 degrees with partly cloudy skies in downtown Columbus. The clouds will increase with increasing chances of rain today. Expect some showers later this afternoon and a high of 48. Showers and thunderstorms are likely tonight, a low of 39 degrees. There's a slight chance of rain for Friday, a high of 40 degrees, and expect a chance of snow Friday night, a low of 28. Looking ahead to the weekend, a chance of snow showers for Saturday morning, partly sunny later in the day, a high of 34. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Yesterday, this week, American war correspondent Marie Colvin and French photojournalist Remy Olschlik were killed in Syria. The Committee to Protect Journalists reported that at least 46 journalists were killed worldwide last year, with Pakistan the deadliest country for the second year in a row. Journalists risk their lives daily to report from war zones around the world, and they're coming under increasing attack, often without the benefit of prompt medical attention for life-threatening injuries. Joining us now is author and documentary filmmaker Sebastian Younger, who has founded a medical training program for journalists covering violent conflicts. Sebastian is the author of The Perfect Storm, among other books. His most recent book came out last spring, the title, War. I first interviewed Sebastian in November 2010 about his documentary film Restrepo, about a platoon of U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, which he made with fellow journalist Tim Hetherington. Last April, Tim Hetherington was killed alongside photographer Chris Hondros while covering the conflict in Libya. Welcome back to the show, Sebastian.
Thank you very much.
You and Tim faced danger together in your work on Restrepo, a documentary that chronicles a platoon of U.S. soldiers in the Korangal Valley, one of the most dangerous places on Earth, certainly the most dangerous regions in Afghanistan at that time, at least. To what extent did you think about the danger in terms of yourself at that time?
Well, you always think about the danger. I was with, Tim and I were with a unit of U.S. military, infantry, and I felt very safe with them. And I thought, it really felt like if something happened to one of us, that we'd get taken care of. I mean, you take your chances in combat. I mean, that's just part of the game. But I felt like there was medical help, expert medical help right by our side. And that's very different from most of the wars that journalists cover. I mean, I started out in Bosnia. I was in Sierra Leone, Liberia. You're kind of on your own in those situations. And if you get hit, if you get wounded, you might get local medical care, but that's about it. And it feels very different to be in a situation where you've got no support network at all around you.
Tim was only 40 years old when he died, and he'd spent most of his professional life documenting the human cost of war. Of course, I interviewed him as well in 2010. You say that Tim's death changed your life and inspired you to found Reporters Instructed in Training Colleagues.
In Saving Colleagues.
I'm sorry, in Saving Colleagues.
Yeah. Tim's injury was possibly survivable. I mean, he was Gaddafi forces launched an 8mm mortar that landed in the middle of a group of journalists and Libyan people. And Tim caught some shrapnel in his groin, and he bled out over the course of the next 5 or 10 minutes. It was a very dangerous wound, but there are things you can do. Tim was about 10 minutes away from medical help, and so all they had to do was really slow down bleeding enough to get him to the hospital alive, and then the doctors would have taken over. But no one really knew what to do. And so the training program is basically designed to prevent the next Tim. It's once a year in New York, once a year in London, once a year in Beirut. It's a free 3-day course taught by former combat medics. It's the lodging is free. We've paid the hotels for people. You just have to get yourself there. The course is free, and you get a medical kit. And the expectation is that once you've been trained, you will never be on a front line without your medical gear. That just becomes kind of an industry norm. And I'm hoping within some years that reporters will refuse to work with other reporters who haven't been trained. I mean, I'm really hoping it sort of gets to that level.
You know, when you watch the movies, it looks like everybody knows how to use a tourniquet, but that's not the case. In fact, it's the simplest or what appears to be the simplest techniques are not common knowledge.
Well, a lot of it is sort of muscle memory. Like when wounded people are frightening, mm-hmm. you know, and they're intimidating, and I've been around them, and you don't know what to do, and you kind of panic, and they're wounded usually in situations where there's more shooting, and so even if you technically know what to do with the tourniquet, it's a different matter doing it in a moment of great urgency. So part of the training, the reason it's 3 days instead of 1 day. Is just so that you have 3 days to sort of go through this stuff and do it over and over and over again, so that it's more or less a reflex if you ever need it.
Most war correspondents are freelancers who can't necessarily afford the cost of medical training like this, which is one of the reasons why you're offering it this way. Are you getting any interest from larger organizations, the wire services and the big networks?
Well, they sort of... corporate news world, the staff, the reporters who are the producers, the cameramen who are insured, they often, part of the insurance package is that, you know, you have to be trained for hazardous environments. And so most of these people have gone through a hazardous environment course. The courses, strangely, don't really focus on medical issues very much. I don't know why, but... So we're not really concerned with them. They have resources. The freelancers are the ones who are doing almost all the war reporting. I mean, you know, very highly paid network correspondents, you really don't get shot at very much. But the, you know, 25-year-old freelancers are sort of the foot soldiers of the press corps, and they absorb almost all the casualties. And, you know, in Libya, almost everyone there was freelance, and they have no support network, none. They're just out there on their own. And for the media, they're a cheap date. I mean, you go to Libya on your own with your own gear, your own cameras. You don't have insurance through anybody. And you sell your photos, you know, at $500 a pop to whoever wants them. I mean, that's a cheap date. And what I'm going to do to fund my organization is I'm going to basically corporate media and saying, you know, you've been subsisting off this material for years, and now's the time to protect these people, because they work very hard and they take enormous risks for all of us.
My guest is Sebastian Younger. He's a journalist, author, and documentary filmmaker. He is the founder and executive director of a new organization. It's called Reporters Instructed in Saving Colleagues. If you have a question or comment for Sebastian, you can give us a call. He's just going to be with us for another 10 minutes. The number's 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We welcome them. One area in which many international news organizations have provided better support for journalists in recent years is coping with the stress and trauma. And you mentioned that journalists don't often deal with the medical aspects of war, that part of it. And I wonder if it's because of the traumatic impact it could have if you look at it too closely.
I don't think it's that. I think it's just that they're busy, they're broke. They're naturally risk takers. I mean, you don't get into the business if you're not a risk taker and somewhat of a fatalist. And you kind of compartmentalize the danger because you don't want to think about it. So you just think, okay, I hope this turns out well, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. But I'm not going to do this job because I'm in love with it. You know, it's a little bit more like that. They're also, most freelancers are very young, and many are in their, you know, they're wounded in their first war. I mean, in Libya, there were a lot of first-time reporters, and they got in trouble. They'd never been in a war before, and the front lines were completely open and accessible to them, which is rare.
The risk course that you're establishing, it'll be taught by experienced medics, many with extensive combat experience. Where will they come from? Who are they?
Well, we get the instructors from a group called Wilderness Medical Associates, and they provide medical training. They provide instructors for medical training to all kinds of organizations, including the U.S. military. They train the instructors at Outward Bound, the Wilderness School, and we have contracted them to do the training for us. Again, it's a three-day training course in New York. The first course will be about 25 people. It will be on the anniversary of the attack in Misrata that killed Tim and Chris. And, you know, in addition to training them, of course, we're hoping to also sort of raise awareness about the risks that journalists run. And, you know, often journalists are, they're not just hit by some random metal. They're actually targeted. And I think that's beyond our scope. But, I mean, you know, the truth is that there are governments like the Assad government that I think do have an interest in keeping the media out of their country and from covering these atrocities. And anyone who goes in there to cover it is running an enormous personal risk.
Because they're not there with permission. Marie Colvin and the photojournalist from France, neither of them, no one is there with permission.
They're not there with permission, and they're not there with any access to medical help if something terrible happens. I mean, you know, they're kind of stuck. I mean, you get wounded in a situation like that, and you're looking at a 12-hour, you know, truck ride out to the nearest border. You know, I mean, a lot of survivable wounds aren't going to pass that test. It's very scary.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Once again, I'm speaking with Sebastian Younger, journalist, author, and documentary filmmaker, and founder and executive director of Reporters Instructed in Saving Colleagues. Sebastian, how much interest have you had in this? You said there's 25. Is it all filled up?
Well, we intentionally put a limit of 25 just because we need to, you know, it's our first one. We need to make sure it goes well. But there's an enormous amount of interest, and we want to make it accessible. So we'll have another training session in London in the fall, and then in Beirut, and maybe eventually in Bangkok. But we want this to sort of be regional, so that people don't have to fly all the way to New York to get to our training session. But there's sort of corporate interest. We're starting to pull money in, and I mean, you know, this was just an idea a few months ago, and it's happening. And I'm sort of amazed that we pulled it off.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Yes, I was wondering about the Anthony Shadid case, that he couldn't get to the border or a hospital, plus he didn't have medicine with him, apparently.
He had an asthma attack.
Correct.
Yes, but, you know, my father has asthma, and I know how debilitating that can be, and I don't know the details of his death. It was a real tragedy. I don't know if he had medicine on him or not. I mean, it sounds like he died pretty quickly. And, you know, there's some situations that you're just not going to be able to prevent. And that may have been one of them. But it did, you know, I mean, in a strange way, it did get people thinking once again about, as the tragedy in Homs did, about the risks that journalists take. And, I mean, you don't have to die from a bullet to die in a war zone. And, you know, he had an asthma attack that he would have survived in New York City, but he died because of where he was. And we all need to sort of recognize that, I guess.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Chris. There is the Committee to Protect Journalists. What does that do, and how does it contrast with what you do?
We're actually working with them.
Okay.
We're sort of partnered with them on this. They're more of an information gathering and disseminating organization. They track journalist casualties, and they communicate with the journalist community. I mean, they're not actually training people hands on. They also develop a sort of guidebook for journalists, so sort of best practices in war zones, and every year they publish a back book detailing the casualties that have happened in the profession. So they're basically reminding us all of the risks and the solutions.
You wrote a Vanity Fair article in June. It was titled The Hetherington Doctrine, and you wrote that Tim Hetherington hated war but supported humanitarian intervention, including the use of military force against a government carrying out widespread human rights violations. And that seems to be the case in Syria right now. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about the United States involvement or lack thereof?
Well, all the wars I have covered, starting in Bosnia, have been ended by military action by a Western power. Bosnia, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Kosovo, and even Afghanistan. I mean, we all forget that, I mean, as bad as things are there now, this is still the lowest level of civilian casualties in that country in 30 years. Then the Civil War of the 1990s was a complete bloodbath, and that ended when the U.S. forces arrived. So I think I can speak for almost the entire press corps in saying that in some of these wars that are going on and causing enormous suffering, the West has to do something. And usually it doesn't take much. Afghanistan's the exception, but usually it's a very limited operation and it really works. Syria, I've never worked in Syria. It's a very complex situation, and I would hate to suggest a solution to it, but I think the important point is that we can't say, well, it's not us, it's not our problem. Someone else's problem eventually becomes our problem, as we saw in the chaos of Afghanistan in the 1990s that produced 9/11 for us. We do have to focus on it. And then there's just the issue of human suffering. You can't just turn a blind eye to human suffering.
Just days after Tim Hetherington's death in Misrata, the Libyan city, another Libyan city, renamed its largest square after him. Anti-Gaddafi protesters also held a march to the newly renamed Tim Hetherington Square in his honor. What did you think of that? That was in, I can't pronounce the name of the city, I'm sorry. Adabia?
I think it was Ajdabia, but yes. I may be wrong.
Ajdabia,
Ajdabia. I was tremendously moved by that. I mean, here's, you know, Tim was a foreigner. He hadn't been there that long, and he died. And I think Libyans understood that along with all the sort of Libyan martyrs in this cause, there was a foreigner who came to their country, who cared enough about what was going on to risk his life covering it, and he died. And on some basic human level, I think they understood the significance of that. And I haven't gone to see it yet. I'm waiting for Libby to calm down. But there it is, Tim Hetherington Square. I mean, it's almost kind of surreal. And Tim would just think, I mean, Tim had a tremendous sense of humor, and he would just thought that was absolutely hysterical.
Well, Sebastian, I'm so sorry for the loss of your friend and colleague.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Take care.
Sebastian Younger, he's a journalist, author, and documentary filmmaker, and founder and executive director of Reporters Instructed in Saving Colleagues. If you want to learn more about that, we'll have a link to that organization on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, more on Syria. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. And in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins with Queen Elizabeth, The Life of a Modern Monarch. That discussion with an author and biographer begins at 11 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Clintonville Academy, offering college prep education for pre-kindergarten through 8th grades and hosting an open house on Sunday, February 26th from 2 to 4 p.m. with faculty and tours available. Details at clintonvilleacademy.org.
Get daily updates from our newsroom by signing up for our daily News Loop e-newsletter. All you have to do is go to WOSU.org/email to sign up. You can also connect with our news team by following WOSU News on Twitter or like our station on Facebook. Partly cloudy skies and it's 46 degrees in downtown Columbus. There is an increasing chance of rain throughout the afternoon today, a high of 48. Showers and thunderstorms are likely tonight, a low of 39 degrees. A slight chance of rain mixing with a little light snow on Friday, a high of 40. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Obama Press Secretary Jim Carney announced this week that the U.S. may consider taking, quote, additional measures, end quote, in Syria if military attacks on civilians continue.
We don't want to take actions that would contribute to the further militarization of Syria, because that could take the country down a dangerous path. But we don't rule out additional measures that, working with our international partners, that the international community might take.
So these additional measures could include arming the opposition against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, among other things. Joining us now to talk about the continuing violence and President Assad's continuing assault on civilians is Peter Mansour. Peter is the Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair in Military History at OSU, where his interests include modern U.S. military history, World War II, the Iraq War, and counterinsurgency warfare. Before coming to Ohio State, he served as executive officer to General David Petraeus, then commander of the multinational forces in Iraq. He's been with us many times before. Welcome back, Peter.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
The wave of Arab unrest that started in Tunisia early last year reached Syria last March when residents of a very small city there started to protest the torture of some students who had put some graffiti out, an anti-government graffiti up. The government responded immediately and with heavy-handed force right away. How did that response there mimic or contrast with other locations of unrest at the time, and how does that bring us to where we are today?
Well, I think the Arab Spring is fed on itself as it sort of spreads from country to country across the region. A lot of the dynamics are the same. You got a large pool of unemployed youth and a lot of discontent with autocratic regimes that don't allow a lot of freedom. But the history of the opposition in Syria goes way back. There was a very brutal insurgency between 1976 and 1982. Finally crushed by Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, when he destroyed the city of Hama and killed 10 to 20,000 people in the process, or at least a portion of the city, and basically plowed under the Sunni area of the city and made it a parking lot. There was a great article written about that called Hama Rules, which is the rules of the game are if you cross me, I'm going to crush you. And I think his son has adopted the same stance.
There was hope that he would be different. He was educated in the West and hope that things would change.
Yeah, there was hope, but the apple doesn't fall far from the tree in this case. And he rules with the support of only about a third of the Syrian people, the Alawite sect, which is a Shia sect, which holds most of the positions of power and influence in Syrian government and in the economy. And, of course, that means that the other two-thirds of the people are pretty discontented, and now they've risen up.
My guest is Peter Mansour, retired Army colonel and Raymond E. Mason, Jr. Chair in Military History at OSU. If you have a question or comment for Peter, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about Syria and what our role would be in terms of U.S. military intervention or at least humanitarian aid. In Syria, there's something bordering on like a civil war. Is with a government in exile, the Syrian National Council. How does that play into the trouble here, the confusion?
I think what you're seeing is the beginning of an insurgency, and it may progress to a full-fledged civil war at some point. It seems to be on the verge of that right now.
So an insurgency is an organized effort versus
to overthrow the government.
Just unrest. Okay.
Correct. And as this thing organizes from protests to some sort of organized opposition, now you're seeing things like suicide bombers, improvised explosive devices, the roadside bombs, the same sort of things we saw in Iraq and are seeing today in Afghanistan. And what will turn this into a civil war, you see pieces of the Syrian army cleaving off and becoming the Free Syrian Army. And if enough of them do that, then you will actually have a civil war in which you have military factions fighting each other openly. And that'll be pretty devastating for the country, but it's the way it's going right now.
Are they cleaving to that organization, the Syrian National Council? Is that where they're going, or it's not clear?
It's not clear. I think different parts of the insurgency, different parts of the rebels have different motivations. And One thing is clear. I think the Muslim Brotherhood has a lot of power among the opposition to Bashar al-Assad.
So the question is, there's a lot of ethnic divisions in Syria. Who do we? It's not a matter of one or the other when it comes to getting involved.
You know, from a humanitarian aspect, you want the government to stop killing civilians. From a strategic aspect, you have to really think hard about who you want to win this conflict. If the opposition comes into power and it is beholden to a very hardline Muslim Brotherhood type government, you might see an environment in which, say, Al-Qaeda would be welcome. If Assad wins, then he's an Iranian protege, and he, of course, and Syria becomes a bulwark of Iranian hegemony in that area, to include in Lebanon. I think from that standpoint, given our conflict with Iran right now in the region, it would be a good thing to see Bashar al-Assad fall, but we want to make sure that the subsequent government is shaped such that it represents all the Syrian people and not just an extreme faction.
John in Marysville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you, Ann. I guess what I'm going to ask is, you know, with all the problems that we're having in our own country with the economy, I just want to, and I'm in between on this, I just want a couple of compelling reasons why the United States feels that we need to intervene in these matters. And I guess I'm going to just maybe, you know, preface my remark by saying that when I listened to the Republican candidates last night with Iran, their view was that, well, we had an opportunity of putting a pro-American government in. And I guess, you know, who are we to determine whether or not a pro-American government is in there? I'm asking for you to give me two or three reasons. Are they moral reasons? Are they strategic reasons? Why should the United States be taking an active role in the affairs of other nations?
Okay. Thank you, John.
Well, I'll limit it to Syria. I'm going to give you zero because I don't think we should get involved. I think our biggest concern is one of humanitarian.
And that's a different question.
Exactly. Okay. We right now, upwards of perhaps 8,000 civilians have been killed in this conflict. And there is an emerging doctrine among the United Nations called the responsibility to protect, that we should not stand by and see civilians slaughtered in places like Rwanda, where a million were killed. And obviously the most recent manifestation was the intervention in Libya. They're now applying that responsibility to protect doctrine in Syria. But, you know, I do not think that we should get involved in a military way there, that our involvement should be on a more moral plane, which is why I am a little bit disturbed that Russia and China vetoed the latest Security Council resolution decrying the violence in Syria.
Well, in Libya, there was involvement, and it was considered by many to be pretty successful. It was limited. There were no boots on the ground, but it helped.
Yeah,
what's the difference?
Well, for one thing, it remains to be seen, because these things aren't over until they're over. We don't know what kind of government's going to emerge in Libya. So be careful what you wish for. Depending on what kind of government emerges, it could be a good deal. It could be a bad deal, and we will just wait and see. NATO had or at least France and Britain had a huge role in bringing about the result in Libya. I don't think the same is going to apply in Syria. Harder to get to, for one thing. It's a landlocked country, you pretty much. Very difficult to get aircraft in if you're going to implement some sort of no-fly zone. So I just don't see the same sort of operation taking place in Syria. Whether there would be any sort of covert arming of the Syrian Free Army remains to be seen. But really, I think that should be up to the people in the neighborhood. The Turks obviously would have a role, the other Arab nations. I would agree with the caller. We should just stay out except for moral exhortation. And we should be very clear on that we decry what the Syrian government has done And if they continue to do it, then they lose the trust and confidence, the respect of the West, and then we will back the other side.
There is to be an international conference tomorrow that will discuss humanitarian aid to the civilians, but so far the government of President Bashar al-Assad has resisted calls even to halt the shelling for even a few hours to get aid to those areas.
Exactly, because the whole reason of shelling the area is to put pressure on the other side to cease and desist. This again goes back to Hama.
This is war.
Yeah, this is Hama rules, the way his father ruled. The other side rises up. The only way we can stay in power is to crush them militarily, and that includes shelling civilians. That is exactly what he wants and exactly what he's trying to do. He doesn't want to allow aid to get to those civilian areas. He wants them to hurt. And if they hurt enough, in his view, then they'll stop the rebellion.
Now, Russia, as you mentioned earlier, a Syrian ally, and has said it will not attend the conference, nor will Iran. This is probably not a surprise, but it is... It is not about war. It's about humanitarian aid.
From our point of view.
Right.
From the other point of view, Iran wants Bashar al-Assad's regime to remain in power. And so it'll back what he's doing. Russia views Bashar al-Assad as a protege, and so they'll back what he's doing. And from Bashar al-Assad's point of view, the only way to stay in power is to suppress the other side brutally, the way the Iranians did when the Green Revolution sprang up in that country in 2009.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Peter Mansour will be with us for a few more minutes if you want to get your question or call in. You can also go to Facebook page and post it that way. Now, we said earlier at the top, the Obama administration so far has rejected calls to arm Syrian opposition, but said earlier this week that additional measures might be considered if the government assault on civilians continues. What are the options? When they talk about additional measures, what could they be?
Well, you can freeze Syrian assets in the United States. You can put an economic embargo on the country. You can squeeze it with sanctions. There's all sorts of things short of military action that you can do. You can take legal action. And all those things could have some impact, but they're very slow moving. As we can see in the case of sanctions over the Iranian nuclear program, sanctions take a long time to work. And meanwhile, the civilians are being killed by the hundreds and the thousands.
Particularly when they have the support of Russia and Iran.
Exactly.
How likely is it that other members of the world community would take action if the U.S. doesn't?
It depends. The folks in the region might take action.
Turkey,
Saudi Arabia. There's folks with more skin in the game than we have. Interestingly enough, Iraq may have a role, but it's unclear which side that they'll back. Now, during the Iraq war, suicide bombers transited through Damascus Airport on the way to Iraq to support the Al-Qaeda in Iraq organization. Now you see some signs that the Iraqi government is actually supporting Bashar al-Assad's regime against the rebels, and that's pretty easy to explain. The Iraqi government is mostly Shiite, and the rebels in Syria are mostly Sunni. And so, again, you have this sectarian idea of where you sit is where you stand. And also, I think it may show that the Iraqi regime is veering towards Tehran in terms of its politics.
Just to veer away from this for just a moment, Afghanistan, our sights have been averted for now by Syria, but Afghanistan, the situation there, what's your estimation of that now in the United
States? Well, it veered away for like a nanosecond now with the burning of the Qurans and the massive protests. We're right back to looking at Afghanistan again. I think that... the conflict in a military sense is unwinnable, but that doesn't mean we're going to lose either. What we're going to do is back out slowly over the next couple of years. By 2014, most of our combat forces will be gone. We'll leave trainers behind and a lot of special forces teams and air power. And then we'll force the Afghans to defend their government. We'll see if that works. By all accounts, the Afghan army is getting a lot better, but there's not enough of them. There are 300,000, which is about half of what they need to fight this counterinsurgency conflict. There's a lot of hope that negotiations with the Taliban, which have begun, will bear some fruit. We'll see. The Taliban's under great pressure. We've killed a lot of their mid-level leaders with these night raids and drone strikes. But the best time to negotiate is obviously when the other side feels a little bit vulnerable, and it's unclear right now what the Taliban is thinking. So this we'll have to see this play out.
The U.S. military seemed to respond very immediately to the burning of the Quran and the news of that. What did you think of that response, and do you think it makes any difference since these protests are going on in spite of it?
Well, General Allen did a great job. He came out immediately. He said this was an accident, which if you look at the Quran, it takes into account, it realizes that people make mistakes. He apologized for it. And I think cooler heads will eventually prevail. But on a visceral level, this, again, is going to incite some of the Afghan people who just want the occupier or what the, you know, who they view as the occupier out of their country.
And there are forces there that would revel in this,
yes,
take advantage of it.
And they're being whipped up right now. But I think if you look what President Karzai has said about the incident, he says this was an accident. It was was not intentional. And I think eventually cooler heads will prevail, but not before there's more violence, protests, and unfortunately some deaths.
Thanks for joining us, Peter Mansour.
Thank you.
Thanks. Peter Mansour, retired Army Colonel and Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair in Military History and author of Baghdad at Sunrise, A Brigade Commander's War in Iraq. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.